My name is David Goldstein.
And I'm Brian Brinkman.
And you are listening to the first episode of the Beyond the Pond podcast. This is the podcast in which Brian and myself will use the lens of the rock band Phish in order to sort of spin off and introduce the listener to other bands and other songs that we think that if you enjoy Phish, you will like very much.
Yeah, David and I are both devoted Phish fans. We see a bunch of shows every year. We listen to a ton of Phish in our free time and analyze Phish in the nerdy ways that everyone else does. But we've also got some pretty diverse musical tastes. I don't spend a lot of my time, I know you don't either, David, listening to a ton of jam bands outside of Phish and the Dead.
Not that there's anything wrong with that. But.
No. I've had some fun at a couple String Cheese shows, I won't lie. But we both have some pretty diverse tastes, a pretty heavy interest in music history, and we wanted to use this podcast as a medium to talk about Phish, but also talk about a lot of other music that we think you'll enjoy if you like particular Phish jams.
Yeah, I mean, we love Phish. We it certainly brought us together. We yep. love Phish fans, but you know, it's part of the problem with Phish fans is sometimes all they listen to is Phish. So we're hoping to maybe try to rectify that situation with this podcast, have some fun, take some deep dives, and also it's very much a work in progress, and both of us happen to be podcast neophytes. So I would say if you like what you hear, bear with us. And we're on Twitter at underscore Beyond the Pond. So, yeah, we definitely would love to hear any and all feedback that you may have. Now, at this point, I think I'm ready to get to the Phish.
Absolutely. I'm always down to get some Phish. All right, so our jam of our first episode is one that is probably, it's fair to say this is a favorite jam amongst most Phish fans, or lots of Phish fans, I would say at least. Would you agree, David?
Oh, yeah. This practically needs no introduction. Let's do it anyway.
This is the Camden 99 Chalk Dust Torture, or as it's affectionately known as the Camden Chalk Dust. This is one of my favorite Phish jams of all time. I will never forget the first time I heard this, buying the Live Phish 08 disc that came out. Not really impressed by the set list that I was reading, but nevertheless, I was going to buy every single Live Phish in order as they came out, and I noticed immediately that the Chalk Dust went a bit astray, and it just kept going and going and going, and it's one of those jams that I throw on a regular basis, and it always takes me to that place. It's a fantastic, fantastic example of Phish locking in a really, really tight, really special way through improvisation. So we felt that this was a really great jam to kick off our first episode in our podcast with, mainly because so many fans connect with it, but also because when we started talking about this jam, both David and I found ourselves just spitting out artists and songs and styles of music that we really felt were closely tied to this the style that Trey's playing during this jam and the band is jamming on together. You know, there's very much of a Frippian and Eno-based influence to this, which guided so much of Phish's musical direction throughout 1998 and 1999. But then there's also the electronica and dance-heavy bass that takes over the song towards the end that really transitions into what happened towards the fall and especially in that December 99 tour build-up towards Big Cypress. So we felt that this was just a really perfect celebratory way to kick off our show. Just briefly, from a historical standpoint, you know, this came in a really interesting place in the tour. It was very early in a tour that started in Bonner Springs, Kansas, kind of wove its way through the Southeast. There was a really fantastic two-night run in Atlanta over the 4th of July, really unique Virginia Beach show. But then this kind of snuck up on the fans, and you know, it's a lot of one-off shows at this point in time, and there were some really good one-off shows towards the end of the tour, but this comes right as they're about to go into Great Woods, right as they're about to go to Homedel. There's some fantastic playing on 7:13, another classic show, 7:15, both the first and second set, and then the lead up to the Quasi Festival at Oswego. I find for myself, when I listen to this jam, the fact that it's the second song in the set, and it's coming out of a song that doesn't jam as much as, or didn't jam at that time really at all, as Chalk Dust did, it just kind of shows that the band was really ready to explode with this tour, and was ready to kick off some really great shows, which they did over the next 10 to 12 days or so. So, David, you were at this show. What were your thoughts?
Well, first of all, I would argue that 7:13:99 was a great show. I was also at that show and must have checked my watch four or five times during that Wolfman's Brother. And I still feel that way 18 years after the fact. Think it's overrated, but getting back to 7:10:99, I was indeed at that show, and it was interesting. With the handful of shows I saw in July 99, I thought that the first set was significantly better than the second set. I'd also say that about the next two shows, July 12th and July 13th of Great Woods, both had really good first sets. But yeah, just about the venue, what's interesting. I think at the time it was called the E Center. It's been like the Sony Blockbuster Center, the Susquehanna Bank Center. It's basically, it's a typical big outdoor shed with a lawn in Camden, New Jersey, which is across the river from Philadelphia. And with the way that venue is set up, if you're on the lawn off to your left, you can see the Philadelphia skyline. So during that Chalk Dust torture and into the Roget, which very nicely segued, you could see a gorgeous sunset over the Philadelphia skyline, which was incredibly apropos for the portion of the Chalk Dust torture that everyone thinks is the excellent highlight of that Chalk Dust torture. So you would go from this very blissful jam where you felt like you were floating 2 inches off the ground, the entire band is locked in, you look over and you see the sunset, it goes into the Roget, and that was, you know, one of those things that you could only feel if you were at the show. And that first set in general is fantastic. It also has the really excellent Bathtub Gin with the improv based on the Spencer Davis Group's I'm a Man. It has Jimmy Smith's Back of the Chicken Shack, which I think they played a few times in 99. And not everybody knows this, but it has probably the best version of Water in the Sky the band has ever played. And that's certainly something that you don't really think warrants like a best of, but seriously, go back and listen to that Water in the Sky. It seems like it's got loops, it's got solos, it's long, and I think I may have used the bathroom during some of it, which I really regret doing in back in retrospect. Set two's odd. It has a very long, very slow, very ambient tweezer. It's got two Trey ballads, because they do Mountains in the Mist and When the Circus Comes. It's got a Type 2 Birds, which is the highlight of the set, and then they close with Fluffhead. And the second set was like 65 minutes, and I left thinking, that's it? No, but when it came out on Live Fish 8, you listen back to it and you think, okay, the Chalk Dust and the first set, this is why it was a Mike favorite. This is why it came out as Live Fish 8. This is why we're talking about today.
You know, two things, just points of a note. The Water in the Sky, I completely agree. It's got to be the best version, if not one of the, you know, few best that they've ever played. It really goes to show for me, when they play a jam on par with the Chalk Dust earlier in the set, it has a overall effect over pretty much anything that they play throughout the rest of the set. They're just locked in at that point, and it's almost one of those moments where it really doesn't matter what they play next, be it a song as standard, usually as Water in the Sky, or another great jam like that Gin. But in terms of the theme, the the water in the sky really carries over a lot of the musical themes. It feels like to me that the Chalk Dust has. And so I just find that really interesting. Whenever you hear a jam like the Chalk Dust, you're usually going to hear something else in the set that's completely unexpected, but, you know, brilliant as well. And then, you know, for better or worse, the second set of 7, 10, 99 was my go-to study album in college. So say what you will about it, but it served a purpose for me a couple years later.
You know, I mean, I have no issue with Trey Ballads. I think Mountains in the Mist and When the Circus Comes are high-quality Trey Ballads. But, I mean, you know, no one wants to hear Jerry do Stella Blue and Black Peter in the same set.
I would happily welcome Mountains in the Mist back. I think it's been 4 or 5 years now since we've heard one. Probably longer than that, actually. I heard...
They may have played it in 2015 on one of the rarity shows. Don't quote me on that. I think it was...
I'm aware of is Telluride, but I'd have to go back and do a little bit of research on that. Anyway, you know, it's interesting you talk about that sunset. For me, when I listen to this song, it just sounds like Phish playing during the greatest sunset you've ever seen. So to know that that's happening over the City of Brotherly Love is, for someone who was not there, it's just a great image to put together the jam and the actual moment.
Right. Yeah, Camden is not the City of Brotherly Love, but
well, right over Philly.
Over Philly, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, very cool. So, I think that we've got some good thoughts over here about the actual jam. So, before we get into talking about this into like a larger musical context, you want to listen to a bit of the jam here, David?
That's a good idea.
All right, let's cue it on up.
think we can place that fish jam in the pantheon of things that certainly do not suck. And
putting it very lightly.
We have, in terms of feelings that we sort of got from that, what we compiled was drunk during sunset, quite possibly hovering 2 inches off the ground with a shit-eating grin. And that was certainly how I felt back on July 10, 1999.
The way I feel every time I listen to that jam is a good reminder of why I'm still a big Fish fan.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's what it's about. That's just the anticipation that these guys are capable of pulling something like that off in any given night is why I've seen them as many times as I have since 1995, which is why, because you never know if it's going to be the night when they're going to do that. And even if they can't reach those heights every night, chances are they'll get pretty close.
Right. Yeah, that from a stylistic standpoint, I think that we both charted out heroic guitar solos, which Trey clearly throws out there, celebratory melodies, 80s soundscapes, and tribal dance melodies. It kind of compiles this very driving song. It feels, in some cases, like the ultimate road trip, just all in 13 minutes. Maybe one that's at, you know, 90 miles an hour across the Southwest.
I can see that. So now, in terms of, I guess, the songs that it reminds us of in terms of historical lineage, Brian, what'd you pick out?
So I think we both agreed there's a ton of Robert Fripp influence in this jam. It's almost as though Trey is just deliberately channeling Robert Fripp through this. You feel the same way?
Absolutely. It's full on Frippertronics up in there.
Yes. And for us, you know, we both I think we started with a really modern song that really, to me, from a melodic standpoint, from a driving standpoint, feels a lot like this Camden Chalk Dust. And that's LCD Sound System's All I Want, which is off their 2010 record, This Is Happening. My personal favorite song of the year 2010. One of my favorite LCD songs. It really sounds as though he is lifting Robert Fripp off of throughout this song in the same sort of way that Trey does in the Camden Chalk Dust. What are your thoughts?
Oh, no. I mean, that song off that record is, in every sense of the word, a Fripp tribute. And even going further, I would say, in addition to Robert Fripp, that song will lead you directly to the David Bowie classic Heroes off the album of the same name. That's a song that probably most of us have heard. I would say go back and listen to it again, because in addition to having the same melodic drive, the solos on that record are powered by Robert Fripp. He plays all over the Heroes album. Especially, let me see. I actually just finished reading on Bowie, which was the David Bowie sort of Cliff Notes crash course written by Rob Sheffield, the excellent music critic who's also a extreme Bowie fanatic. And according to him, Robert Fripp was flown in to Berlin to record the solos on the Bowie David Bowie Heroes record, hung out in the studio for a bit, didn't do any sightseeing, didn't go to Brandenburg Gate, literally got back in the cab, hopped back on the plane to go back to the States. So...
believe that if you will.
But yeah, in terms of the wailing melodic solos on that song, that's definitely a tribute in All I Want, and can be traced directly back to the last 5 minutes or so of that Chalk Dust torture.
Yeah, no, I definitely hear that as well. Do you want to give a listen to All I Want and then Heroes?
Absolutely.
All right, very cool.
Time. just for one day.
All right. Hope you guys enjoyed those couple clips off of that and can hear the similarities with LCD. I feel like James Murphy of LCD Sound System, you know, he produced that most recent Arcade Fire record that Bowie's featured on the title track. And there's so much of what he does. I have the same grunt whenever I think about that record. I just felt like it had to be noted. It's not my favorite record at all. But, you know, I feel like there's so much of Bowie that Murphy tries to channel. I don't think a lot of it is entirely successful, but I think he lifts a lot, especially from that Bowie Berlin era.
Right.
But then you hear that in Heroes, that just very underlying driving guitar solo from Fripp that just lingers throughout the entire song. But we would be mistaken if we were not to mention really the origins of the Frippian sound, or one of the best places you could possibly hear it is in Brian Eno's Another Green World. Another Green World was a record I actually found out about. Well, I didn't find out about, but I really started listening to the fall of 2009 when Phish was killing off a bunch of albums ahead of their Festival 8 show. And I went through that list and just downloaded everything that was on there. And Another Green World completely took me. I was raised a very diehard and completely unironic U2 fan. And I think the greatest thing that I picked up from that part of my childhood was a curiosity, at the very least, for Brian Eno, and then later a love for Brian Eno. That album, Another Green World, just gets me. It sounds like you're on a completely different planet. It's kind of like what we were talking about earlier with that Thundercat record, in the sense that it's a lot of musical ideas, not a ton of complete songs, but in those ideas you can hear really musical evolution from a pop standpoint over the next 40 years. The song that we selected for this is called The Big Ship, which is midway through the record. It's really the emotional peak of the album. We're going to do a little bit of a clip off of that, but we would also need to mention that St. Elmo's Fire, the second song on the record, features one of my favorite Fripp solos, and another really, really great example, just not as purely melodic as The Big Ship, that really fits the Camden Choctaw. But what are your thoughts on this record?
I think it's incredible. The Big Ship, to me, that sounds, if somebody could encapsulate the feeling of being born, that's sort of whenever I think of The Big Ship. It's very, to use a cliche, it's quite cinematic. It looks like it should showcase like nature documentaries or that type of thing. And yeah, the guitar solo in St. Elmo's Fire, if you could actually call it that, is it sort of sounds like an old Atari 2600 malfunctioning, except awesome. And let me just say, obviously, Robert Fripp, I think what his discography comprises over like 700 records. He's known for always being the front man for the heavy British prog rockers, King Crimson, mm-hmm. obviously. And maybe my favorite bit of Robert Fripp nerdery is that in 1977, he produced a solo record by Daryl Hall, as in of Hall & Oates. And this was a record called Sacred Songs. It was recorded in 1977. It wasn't released until 1980 because the record company didn't hear a single. And it's great, and it's totally bizarre because you get these, you know, Daryl Hall, Philly soul pop songs, and then out of nowhere you hear like the Robert Fripp soundscapes just like jump into the track. And you think, huh, this is great. I mean, for reasons that maybe God will reveal on the final day of judgment, Robert Fripp got to produce a Daryl Hall album, and it's awesome.
When we were preparing for this podcast over the weekend, you recommended it to me, and I threw it on, and it was one of those records that it's completely bizarre, but really, really, really fantastic, incredibly catchy in a lot of cases. My wife heard me playing it and went over and checked what was on the iPod, and her first reaction was, "Are you really listening to Hall & Oates right now?" And then she kind of just walked away. And but it was a great record. It made my Saturday.
All right. You enjoyed that clip. Briefly, what else have you been listening to as of late that's not Phish that you've been digging?
This week has been all about the new Thundercat LP, Drunk. It's his first one, I believe. He put out an EP in 2015, I want to say. But it's his first full album since 2013's Apocalypse, which was one of my favorite records of that year. It is a bit short on full song ideas, but filled with some of the most just contagious bass lines and danceable riffs that I've heard all year long. It really, really reminds me of this very specific feeling that I got both in early college and when I was living in Asia, that 4 a.m. beer that you just don't need, that just leads to loads and loads of laughter that comes out of nowhere and just a ton of fun with friends. It's a real carefree record, and I'm really, really enjoying it.
Yeah, I have that on my phone. I've been listening to it, and the guy's a monster on bass. You know, that's his main instrument. He comes up with these incredible rubbery bass lines that flow like water, like sort of like a very more Jaco Pastorius than Victor Wooten, I guess. Yeah. But like you said, I'm having a hard time getting around the fact that there's not much in the way of songs. It's a lot of atmosphere. He obviously really digs yacht rock. He's got these falsetto yacht rock vocals all over everything. And he's undeniably talented. I just have to go back and see if there's any hooks, which I'm not entirely sure that there are yet.
I would say, you know, you want to hear the section between, I'm pulling it up on my phone right now, the section between Tokyo and Them Changes. Tokyo, Jamil Space Ride, Friend Zone, and Them Changes, which sounds like it might be a cover. It is not. It is an original from him. That section has the most complete songwriting that I've heard throughout the whole record, and is just super outrageous. What about you, Dave? What have you been listening to?
The thing I would listen to the most this week is an artist who goes by the name of Jay Som. That's J-A-Y space S-O-M. That's actually the nom de rock of a 22-year-old woman whose name I believe is Melina Duterte or Duarte. I'm not entirely sure how her last name is pronounced. But What it is sort of, it's a little over a half hour. It's a relatively short collection of, I guess you could call them fuzzy pop songs. It's almost like some R&B songs, but there's a lot of fuzz around the edges. I guess you could call it lo-fi. There's elements of shoegaze music, which is the genre that I think we're going to explore on this show a few episodes from now. Yola Tango is a band that definitely comes to mind when thinking about her, but it's varied, it's catchy, and it works for my relatively short attention span, and I think she covers a lot of ground in a short amount of time, and I would recommend it highly.
Fantastic. I got that on my list of tunes to be listening to. I hope to get to that sometime tomorrow. It's on my ongoing 2017 new albums list.
Next, we just want to cite some more recent modern examples of songs that sort of encapsulate the feelings that we get from that Choctaw's torture. You know, feelings of ecstasy, feelings of driving rock and roll. The first one I think Brian actually picked was one of the staple songs of a band called Broken Social Scene. It's this was a band, they were a collective of Canadian musicians that they first came on the scene, I want to say 1999, with an album called You Forgot It in People. And it, this is one of the late 90s examples of, I think, the website Pitchfork really breaking a band. And the second song on that record is called Casey Accidental. And it's, we'll play a clip of it for you. It's just driving ecstasy. It's upbeat, it's loud, it's melodic, and we see no reason why you shouldn't enjoy it.
That was Casey Accidental, the second track off of Broken Social Scene's second record, You Forgot It in People. 2002, that record came out. I always think of my freshman year of college with that that album. But yeah, that's the first record that they recorded as like a full 12 to 15 person band. The band that spurred the career of Feist. Brendan Cannon and Kevin Drew, the two founders of the band, recorded a kind of bedroom ambient pop record in 2001 called Feel Good Lost. That
That's right.
Really nice, really lovely record. Nothing too amazing on it. Nothing as incredible as you get throughout Feel Good or You Forgot It in People. But really, really wonderful little sounds there. But that song, man, that was the first record I purchased after reading a Pitchfork review. I was 18, 19, had just found out about Pitchfork, read this incredible review about an album that apparently was going to change all of indie rock, and you know, sparing the hyperbole, I think it did affect a good deal of the genre in terms of its explosiveness and its popularity and its reach from previously unknown artists. But Man, some lasting songs on there. Almost Crimes, Pacific Theme, Cause Equals Time, to go along with Casey Accidental. Just a really, really memorable, complete album. One of my favorites of all time.
Yeah, that was one of those records that when I saw on my then-girlfriend, now-wife's shelf back in 2004 when we first started dating, I said, oh, okay, I could have something here.
It's always a good sign. That's always a good sign. I actually saw them when they reunited back in 2010, and Kevin Drew, who has a reputation for being something of a of an asshole, if you will, in the music scene.
Taskmaster.
Yes, he spent the better part of the second half of the show in an argument with the sound guy, who just looked like a helpless roadie that wasn't, I don't even think he was Broken Social Scenes. I think he was hired on by Pitchfork for the festival. But that's the biggest memory I have from the show, which might be telling you something. So moving on. So Broken Social Scene, really amazing, early aughts group. The next song that we have for you guys is from probably my favorite record of this decade. I don't know if anything has come close to it. I don't know if anything will top it, but off of the War on Drugs, 2014, dare I say masterpiece?
It's a masterpiece. You can definitely say masterpiece. I will back you up on that 100% on this record.
I almost wore it into the ground in 2014. I think I listened to it by the end of the year. I was listening to it at least three or four times a week. It just did not get old and always felt essential to listen to. Really fit where I was at in life at that point in time, coming off of 2 years of traveling around the world and trying to settle into some sort of domesticity. But now I kind of have to give myself a couple weeks break between listening to it to really feel it as much as I did. But we've picked the song Burning, which for me, you know, you talk about like the reverse of the Drunk Sunset. I remember being up in northern Wisconsin with my brother and my dad, listening to this record right in peak fall, right on a dock overlooking a just no-name lake up there in way northern Wisconsin, watching the moon rise up and getting drunk and talking about life, and this song came on, and it just felt like a moment to just cry out to the heavens, which for me is just what the Camden Chalk Dust is.
War on Drugs. What's his name? I'm drawing a blank here. What's his name? I know it's one guy in his band.
Yeah, Adam Granchill.
Adam Granchill, right.
I believe he was 38 or 39 when this record came out, which is really, really amazing.
Well, I mean, I'm 37, so I mean, I don't feel that old, but no, certainly in rock and roll years, to pull out your masterpiece at 38 years of age, that's it's not something you hear every day.
I think.
Him and his band, they specialize in driving road trip, heartland, 80s imbued rock and roll. And I say 80s because the production on that record, it sounds like the album I keep coming back to compare that is like Dire Straits' Brothers in Arms.
Yeah.
Bruce Springsteen's Tunnel of Love. Like, it's got like that shiny, boomy 80s sound, sort of not a corny drum sound, but it, goodness, even something like John Cafferty and the Beaver Brown Band from Eddie and the Cruisers. I'm kind of dating myself with that reference. But that whole album, especially that song, just, it's a road trip record. It sounds fantastic on vinyl, and I definitely played it into the ground very happily. And also, the live show slays. They played Radio City Music Hall, I think, about a year and a half ago, and I was 2 feet off the ground at that show in Silver.
I've seen him three or four times. I was really lucky to get a pass to see them at a guitar shop in Chicago with about 300 other people. Watched them play about a 40-minute set. I was about 10 feet away from the band, and unbelievable. I saw them there. I've seen them about three or four times since in larger venues, and right there with you, 2 or 3 feet off the ground. They just they know how to wield a set list that doesn't feature a ton of different songs, but they know how to pull out a few of their older songs while also kind of mixing things up with their last two records, both Slave Ambient and Lost in the Dream, which they feature most prominently throughout their live shows. But they're really, really, really transfer their songs really well live.
Right. I'm led to believe there's a new record coming out this summer, which is probably my most anticipated album of the year at this point.
It's for me, it's that or The National. And this is, I don't know the last record I've been this nervous about its arrival. I was talking to my dad about it. This was the record that I helped convince my dad that music beyond 1975 was really, really worth listening to. and we've seen them together and both share a great affection for the band. But he and I were talking about it. And we were saying, you know, you're either going to get the best record you've ever heard because it's somehow better than Lost in the Dream, or it's just a reassurance that Lost in the Dream was as good as it was.
Ah, that's wise. That's well put. All right.
So let's listen to a little bit of Burning. We just had Casey Accidental and Burning, Broken Social Scene and the War on Drugs. We wanted to focus right now on one more particular section of the Camden Chalk Dust. And that's the closing, 2 minutes, where Mike really takes over and it almost sounds as though Fish is playing it almost sounds as though they're DJing on stage and they're not actually playing instruments. It's pretty incredible how electronic the last minute or so sounds. What do you think?
No, I agree that the last minute, 2 minutes of that jam gets very, very laptop electronica in the sense. Very beat heavy, very locked in, very mechanical. It isn't the soaring melodic groove that we had previously heard, but it's very technical, almost like the gears of a machine kind of clicking together, and it's extremely impressive.
It's really interesting because it's like a foreshadowing of where jam band music went 5 or 6 years after this. I feel like, you know, you had the Disco Biscuits, they're around by this point, but you really had a full awakening of electronic and dance music by 2003, 2004. But it's really just another example for me of where Fish was ahead of their peers in so many different ways.
Are you talking with things like Soundtribe, Sector 9, or?
Yeah, just the whole
New Deal.
Yeah, the Jamtronica scene, if you will. Right. And I'm going to never forgive myself for saying that over a recording, but that term. but you know what I'm saying? I mean, it's really, and so much of it came out of Trey going and sitting in New York clubs throughout the spring of 1999 as he was forming Tab, and First Tube and Sand obviously came out of that, but it's just great for me to hear. It's really interesting for me to hear them really exploring with that type of terrain that early. So to kind of cap off this section, we wanted to play a song off of a really unique and really lovely 2015 record by Colin Stetson and Sarah Neufeld called Never Were the Way She Was. And Colin Stetson is a baritone saxophonist, I believe I've got that right, who plays some very avant-garde, very experimental music that always kind of toes the line between droning noise-based music and really classical, beautiful underlining melodies. And the song In the Vespers in particular really features him using the saxophone in almost a percussive way and really has a similar vibe to what was going on towards the tail end of that Chalked Us. What are your thoughts on all that?
No, I would concur entirely. I mean, I get a lot of within that song. I mean, there's a lot of Philip Glass influence almost in terms of the ambient like repetition of the saxophone playing. I know it's correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, he does a lot of like looping. Is that correct?
Yeah, almost all of his songs are built out of a loop, and he did a trilogy called History of Warfare over 2009, 2011, right. 2013 that most of the tracks on there would start from like a single riff he was doing on a saxophone and then would build over time to just this really cacophonous, but just it's the kind of music that if you listen to it with headphones on, if you listen to it over and over again, you almost get this melody throughout it that cuts through everything, cuts through all the noise, and I absolutely love it. It was huge for me when I was traveling, and this record was just kind of a transition record for me as I was coming into a new phase of my own personal life, and this song just kind of straddles exactly what we're talking about here, and kind of exactly what was going on towards the end of that Chalked Us right before it goes into Roger.
Let's play it.
Cool. Thank you.
All right. Hope you enjoyed that. And just before we wrap up, I know Brian and myself wanted to give some thanks to some individuals who gave us much encouragement to get this off the ground. I would be RJB, who heads up the Helping Friendly Pod, which is fantastic. Tom Marshall with the Under the Scales podcast, and also more recently, Jonathan Hart, who has the Broke Down Pod. All those guys were really instrumental in getting us started, and I highly recommend you listen to each of those podcasts for Fish. In the case of Jonathan, some Grateful Dead content, because they're all very good guys with some fascinating podcasts. And now also, I guess in conclusion, I'd like to say that, as we stated before, the reason that we decided on the Cannon Chalk Dust, in addition to being very popular and notable jam, is that it really, to us, is the essence of Fish in its sheer melodicism and just the ecstasy of that last 5 minutes to the more mechanical outro towards the end. It's just, it's fantastic. What'd you say, Brian?
Yeah, it is a pure example of why I said it earlier, why I continue to listen to Fish, while continue to listen to Fish no matter what. Really, really amazing jam. I think it was a solid first choice for us. Just to kind of run through for you guys, for anyone who wasn't taking notes throughout the episode, the songs that we featured throughout here and their corresponding albums, in case you want to seek them out from the samples that we played. So the top there, we threw in LCD Sound System's All I Want, which is off of This Is Happening from 2010. Following that was David Bowie Heroes off of the same album title. Brian Eno's The Big Ship concluded that first section off of Another Green World.
And then in terms of the more modern examples, we had Broken Social Scenes, Casey Accidental, the anthemic second song off of their album You Forgot It and People. War on Drugs, Burning from the album Lost in the Dream. And then the last song we played there was Colin Stetson, In the Vespers, off of what album, Brian?
Never Were the Way She Was, excuse me.
Okay. And also, all goes according to plan. This podcast, which I believe is launching in the first April, later on that we'll be planning on having a blog and or Facebook page for both that's going to contain all these songs and the albums that they correspond with the corresponding jams. It's not ready just yet, but I'd say bear with us, and as soon as that is up, we will absolutely let you know.
Absolutely. And once again, you guys can find us for the time being at underscore Beyond the Pond. We're really excited that you guys all joined us for our inaugural episode. We're really stoked about this. We're hoping you guys come back next week. We've got another great Fish jam up for you guys. And please send us your feedback, your thoughts. And thanks so much for taking the time to listen.
Thank you, Brian. Thank you, listeners.
Thank you, David.
All right. Until next time, let's go beyond the pond.